Well, it makes no difference.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is February 14th, 2018. And the title of today's episode is It Makes No Difference, Glucocorticoids for the Treatment of Septic Shock. And our returning guest skeptic is Dr. Rory Spiegel, or otherwise known as EM Nerd. He is a clinical instructor at the University of Maryland, a recent graduate of Stony Brook's Resuscitation Fellowship, and a current Critical Care Fellow at the University of Maryland. He does write this excellent blog called EM Nerd, which he describes as nihilistic ramblings. Welcome back to the SGM, Rory.
Thanks, Ken. It's an honor to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, last time you were here, we were talking about apneic oxygenation during rapid sequence intubation.
Yeah, we did. We had a lot of fun talking nerdy about continuous versus dichotomous endpoints. It was good times.
Oh, good times. But before we get into today's episode, I do want to thank my FOMED friend and presentation Jedi master, Dr. Ross Fisher, for suggesting the theme music. Do you know Ross and his P-cubed approach to presentations?
I know Ross well. I'm not sure he knows me, but he has taught me everything I'm doing wrong about presentations.
Oh, we are just Padawans compared to his Jedi Master presentation skills.
Yes, we are.
All right, give us a case.
All right, so we have a 64-year-old male presenting to the emergency department with worsening abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, and anorexia for the past week. On presentation, he is lethargic and hypotensive. He requires control of his airway and is given 30 cc's per kg of fluid and started on norepinephrine. His urine analysis is consistent with a urinary tract infection. Over the course of his emergency department stay, he is escalating pressor requirements. After starting vasopressin, you ask yourself, should I be adding steroids for potential relative adrenal insufficiency?
Well, corticosteroids have had a tumultuous history when it comes to their treatment for septic shock. The underlying physiological reasoning for it is, in the most part, simple.
Yeah, there's a certain subset of patients in septic shock whose adrenal axis functions well enough to support them in a state of health, but is unable to support them in a state of unwell. It is this state of relative adrenal insufficiency that we hope to combat when administering steroids in patients with septic shock.
But when it comes to the clinical evidence, Rory, supporting the use of glucocorticoid therapy for the treatment of septic shock, we've existed in a state of ambiguity. There have been two contradictory randomized control trials.
Right. The first of these is the Anand trial published in JAMA in 2002, and it suggested a mortality benefit in favor of corticosteroids in the subset of patients who were found to have a relative adrenal insufficiency.
And then the second larger study, the Corticus study, was published in New England Journal of Medicine in 2008, and it found no benefit of the use of corticosteroids compared to placebo.
Now, these contradictory results could have come about for a number of reasons. First, the patients in the Anand trial represented a much sicker population, isolating the subset of patients who would truly benefit from steroid supplementation.
Well, the negative results observed in the Corticus trial were the consequence of enrolling a much healthier population and washing out any chance of identifying the underlying signal.
On the other hand, the results of the Anand trial may have just been due to statistical noise and the small sample size. And the Corticus trial represents nothing more than the expected regression to the mean.
And then, Rory, there was also this Hypris trial that we reviewed on SGM number 168 with Salim Rezaei from Rebel EM. This looked at hydrocortisone to prevent patients with severe sepsis in developing septic shock. While the primary outcome showed no difference between glucocorticoid treatment and placebo, there was also no secondary mortality benefit observed.
Right, and the SGM bottom line from that episode was that the use of hydrocortisone in adult patients with severe sepsis to prevent septic shock cannot be recommended at this time.
And you know what, Rory? We're not even going to talk about vitamin C for sepsis.
No, I think we've covered that enough, Ken.
Yeah, let's avoid that. Okay, give us the clinical question.
All right. Does the administration of continuous effusion of hydrocortisone in a general population of patients with septic shock on mechanical ventilation improve survival?
And what's the reference?
The reference is Venkatesh et al., Adjunctive Glucocorticoid Therapy in Patients with Septic Shock, or the Adrenal Trial, published in the New England Journal of Medicine in January 2018.
All right, here's the PICO. What was the population?
So these were adults age 18 or older who required mechanical ventilation with septic shock, which was defined as two or more SIRS criteria on vasoactive agents for at least 4 hours.
And they excluded some patients, and we'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
The intervention was an IV infusion of hydrocortisone at a dose of 200 milligrams per day for 7 days or until death or discharge from the ICU.
And what did they compare it to?
They compared it to a placebo infusion.
And what was their primary outcome?
Their primary outcome was 90-day mortality from any cause.
And they had a number of secondary outcomes. One of the key ones, I think, was the 28-day mortality from any cause. But I'll list all of them in the show notes. The author's conclusions were, quote, among patients with septic shock undergoing mechanical ventilation, a continuous infusion of hydrocortisone did not result in lower 90-day mortality than placebo, end of quote. All right, let's go through that quality checklist for RCTs, and there are 11 questions. The first one is the study population. Did it include or focus on those in the emergency department?
No, this was primarily an ICU population.
And did they randomize them adequately?
Yes.
Did they conceal the randomization?
Yep.
Did they do an intention to treat analysis?
They did.
Did they recruit consecutively?
Yes.
Were the patients similar with respect to prognostic factors?
It appears so, yeah.
Was everyone unaware of group allocation?
Yes.
Did they treat both groups equally?
Yes, they did.
Was the follow-up complete?
Yes.
Did they consider all patient-important outcomes?
I think they did, yes.
And the last question, the treatment effect. Was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Precise enough, yes. Large enough, no.
So we got, if I remember correctly, 9 yeses and 2 noes.
Exactly.
Let's go through the key results. They enrolled just over 3,600 patients into the study. The mean age of patients was in the early 60s, with approximately 60% being male. What was their primary outcome?
Well, the authors found no difference in all-cause mortality at 90 days. It was 27.9% in the intervention group and 28.8% in the control group.
And that gives you an odds ratio of 0.95. And if you look at the confidence interval, it spans 1, and their p-value is 0.5. So giving all those fancy statistics, what we're saying is they didn't find a difference in all-cause mortality at 90 days. Now, I did mention they had a number of secondary outcomes. I'll list them all in the show notes there. But the key one that I thought that I wanted to point out was the 28-day mortality. There was no difference. Is there any one that you want to point out?
Yeah, I think there's a number of things. The authors cite that the time to resolution of shock was better in the patients who got the corticosteroids. The length of ICU stay and time on mechanical ventilation were all better in the patients who received glucocorticoids.
But just to put a pin on it, these are secondary outcomes that the study wasn't powered for.
Yeah, and I think we'll discuss that later.
All right, and the last thing, of course, is adverse events.
So there was 27 versus 6 adverse events in the glucocorticoid and control group respectively, with hyperglycemia being the most common.
Okay, so it's time to talk nerdy. This was a well-done study. It was a randomized, blinded, multi-center trial with rigorous methods. So let's go through 5 points, and I'll kick it off with the first one. And it's a bit of nitpicking, and this is about the power of the study. It was a little underpowered because the prevalence of mortality was a little less than their estimated 33%. They got in the high 20s for mortality. So when they do their power calculation, they were a little on the low side. They were trying to get 3,800 enrolled into the study. Now, I don't think this fundamentally changes their conclusions or invalidates their results.
No, I tend to agree. I think we didn't even see a real trend to benefit that you could imagine the study was underpowered. All right. And so our second point is the secondary outcomes. And one of the biggest issues in this trial is how exactly do we interpret secondary outcomes? The authors noted that the patients in the hydrocortisone group had a faster time to resolution of shock, a shorter time to discharge from the ICU, and a shorter duration of initial mechanical ventilation. But we all know the dangers of interpreting secondary outcomes as truth. This study was not powered for these outcomes and should be considered hypothesis generating at best. Moreover, although the time to ICU discharge was statistically shorter in patients randomized to receive hydrocortisone, the authors found no difference in the number of days alive and outside the ICU, or the days alive and outside the hospital. And while the duration of initial mechanical ventilation was shorter in the hydrocortisone group, there was no difference in the days alive and free of mechanical ventilation, nor a difference in the rate of recurrent mechanical ventilation. These inconsistencies make one question the true clinical meaning of these outcomes.
And the third point is about statistical versus clinical significance. And the difference between these two is a point we often make on the SGEM. Yes, the authors found a shorter time to resolution of shock in the hydrocortisone group, but the mean difference in MAP between the two groups was only about 5 millimeters of mercury, and there was no difference in the daily dose of norepinephrine. Many findings, especially those measured continuously, so variables like blood pressure, they can be statistically different. It's always important to judge whether these findings will have an effect on clinical outcomes.
Right, exactly. So the next one I found really fascinating, this is the concept of regression to the mean. It's an important concept when appraising a study. The lead author of this trial presented its results at this year's Critical Care Reviews Conference in Ireland, put on by our friend Rob McSweeney. And during the presentation, he showed the results of the various interim analyses that were conducted during the study. During the first analysis, which was over 900 patients, twice that of the Corticus trial, there was a statistically significant improvement in mortality favoring the patients who received hydrocortisone. But over the course of the trial, as the sample size grew larger and larger, this difference disappeared. This is the perfect example of how unstable trials are at small sample sizes. Now, if this study was stopped early after this first interim analysis, we all would have thought steroids were helpful in septic shock, which of course would have turned out to be incorrect. This is not atypical in trials with small sample sizes to have wide variations in point estimates around a true mean that meet our standard for statistical significance. And it's only after a larger validation study is conducted that the point estimate settles around the true effect size.
Yeah, I think this was my favorite nerdy point, the regression to the mean. It's sort of like, you know, you've got a hockey game. A hockey game has three periods. And if you're leading after the first period, you don't go, yay, we won. No, it's a three-period game, and you've got to play out the whole game. And these trials that stop early, and there can just be this bounce back around that mean, and you go, yep, we've got a winner here. Let's call it quits. And you just can't do that. And so hopefully those people outside of Canada will understand the hockey reference. Do you get it, Rory? Do I have to explain it further?
I speak a little Canadian, so I think I get it. I think it's fascinating. I think we try to attempt to solve this by conducting meta-analysis of these little trials, hoping that the real effect size will kind of round itself out as you add all these little studies together. But because of publication bias, you end up just kind of augmenting or exaggerating the deviation in truth. Truly the best trial is just a large clinical trial that has enough statistical power to kind of get rid of that variation in effect size.
I'll have to come up with maybe a football analogy or something like that. What are there? Are there four quarters in football? Like, I'm showing my ignorance.
There are four quarters, yes.
Let's move on. Fifth nerdy point, adverse events. Like many studies, this trial was not as rigorous in assessing adverse events. It was up to the individual clinician to decide if any of the adverse events were related to the trial. And there were four times as many adverse events. Now, that's a small number, so a small number multiplied by four, but there was a small number of adverse events, but there was four times as many adverse events in the hydrocortisone groups. These events weren't independently evaluated, but regardless, if there's no mortality benefit with the treatment, why should patients accept any level of harm?
Right, exactly. If there is no benefit, all we ever can do is harm.
All right. Comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
So the author's conclusions that glucocorticoids do not improve mortality in septic shock is a reasonable assessment. What conclusions we can draw from the secondary outcomes is far less clear.
And how about an SGEM bottom line?
So our bottom line is the administration of a continuous effusion of hydrocortisone to a general population of patients in septic shock on mechanical ventilation cannot be recommended at this time.
Yeah, Rory, it's hard to view these results as anything but a negative study. While there are some potential signals of benefit in patients who receive hydrocortisone, they were fleeting and ultimately had minimal influence on patient-centered outcomes. If a true benefit does exist, it's small and would require an impossibly large trial to empirically demonstrate.
Yeah, Ken, you know, I think despite the results of the adrenal trial, it will paradoxically increase the use of glucocorticoids in patients with septic shock because the desire to act in the face of critical illness is so strong, and the influential power of a statistically significant p-value is even stronger.
All I want to just say is, no! Oh, people should read the article called "Don't Just Do Something, Stand There: The Value and Art of Deliberate Clinical Inertia." And the senior author on it is Dr. Daniel Fadovich. And it is just an excellent explanation on why it can be hard to avoid unnecessary tests and treatments.
Yeah, when faced with a patient with refractory shock, I think many will continue to give corticosteroids in the hopes that they may help the individual patient laying before them. It will just happen with an added degree of hand-wringing, having read the literature refuting this practice and simply wanting nothing to do with its conclusions.
So we're just sort of summarizing that problem with knowledge translation and the leaky pipe model. And one of the things is, yes, I'm aware that the adrenal trial was published. I just don't accept it, or I don't think it applies to my patient. And so there'll be a lot of rationalization. Can you give a case resolution?
Sure can. Hydrocortisone was held, and the patient's shock worsened over the next few hours. A CT abdomen pelvis was ordered because of concern of lack of source control. The imaging identified an obstructive kidney stone with an associated pyelonephritis. Urology was consulted, and a drain was placed. Over the next 24 hours, the patient's shock resolved and he came off his vasopressors.
All right, how about clinically applying this adrenal study?
In an undifferentiated cohort of patients with septic shock, the addition of glucocorticoid therapy does not improve mortality.
And so what are you going to tell the patient's family?
So I would tell his family, your husband and father is fairly sick. We have resuscitated him with IV fluids and medications that will bring his blood pressure up to a safe level. Recent literature suggests that the addition of glucocorticoids does not improve outcomes when compared to standard care. Importantly, a source was identified, and we now think we have control of his infection.
Okay, it's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was Sean Murphy, a PA from Parry Sound, Ontario, Canada. Sean, I think I pronounced your name correctly. He knew the fantastic acronym they gave to the study on IV antibiotics in the pre-hospital setting for sepsis was called the FANTASY trial, and that stood for Pre-Hospital Antibiotics Against Sepsis Trial. Now, Sean has won before, but this time he will be getting one of the cool new skeptical prizes. What's the question this week?
All right, this week's question is, the study is called the adrenal trial. Adrenaline is produced in the adrenal gland. Now, we are not going to get pedantic about whether it should be called adrenaline or epinephrine, but the first scientific rigorous demonstration of a pressor effect of the suprarenal extract was by George Oliver and Edward Schaefer in 1894 at the University College of London. The question for today is, who was the Japanese-American chemist that was credited for isolating adrenaline or epinephrine in 1902?
So if you know the name of this Japanese-American chemist, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive one of our cool new skeptical prizes. And Rory, as being the guest skeptic, I got to send you one of the cool new skeptical prizes.
Oh, can't wait.
Now, there are some other FOMED resources on this. And of course, there's your excellent blog entry in EM Nerd called The Case of the Relatively Insufficient. But there's also stuff from Rebel EM, St. Emlyn's, The Bottom Line, EM Literature of Note, your buddy, Ryan Radecki, and EM Crit. Well, thanks, Rory, for coming back on the SGEM.
Oh, thanks, Ken. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And if you give the tagline.
All right. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you've heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.
Well, it makes no difference how far I go.